LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Peter Jones, who joins us to discuss some of the issues raised in his book, Artificers of Fraud. Wilhelm Reich was an Austrian psychoanalyst, a member of the second generation of psychoanalysts after Sigmund Freud, and one of the most radical figures in the history of psychiatry. He was the author of several influential books, most notably Character Analysis and The Mass Psychology of Fascism. His writing influenced generations of intellectuals, and during the 1968 student uprisings in Paris and Berlin, students scrawled his name on walls and threw copies of The Mass Psychology of Fascism at the police. From the 1930s onward, he became an increasingly controversial figure. After moving to the United States, he coined the term orgone for a cosmic energy he claimed to have discovered, which he said others referred to as God. In 1940, he started building orgone accumulators, devices that his patients sat inside to harness the reputed health benefits. However, following vociferous media criticism, the US Food and Drug Administration obtained an injunction against the shipment of orgone accumulators and of Reich's books. Charged with contempt in 1956 for having violated the injunction, Reich was sentenced to 2 years in prison, and that summer over 6 tons of his publications were burned by order of the court. He died in jail of heart failure just over a year later. Reich's case is both bizarre and disturbing, but it speaks to a situation still prevalent today, in which scientists and researchers beyond the margins of mainstream academia are routinely derided, ridiculed, and in some cases, ruined. In the name of intellectual rigor, a new religion, scientism, has been born.
Hello and welcome, Peter, and thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Greg. It's great to be here.
Peter, today we're going to talk a little bit about some of the issues arising in your book, which is called Artificers of Fraud, The Origin of Life and Scientific Deception. And this orientates around the work of Robert Brown, the botanist. He lived from 1773 to 1858. Also the work of Wilhelm Reich, I should perhaps pronounce that. And he's much better known than Robert Brown, quite a controversial character. But before we get into some of the subjects raised in the book, just tell us a little bit about your background and how you became interested in this topic in the first place.
Well, listeners will be surprised at my background. It's not at all what you'd expect for someone writing a book on the history of science. My original training, qualification, whatever you want to call it, was a degree in languages, which has actually, we can't really go into that here, but it's the way you think when you're working in and out of different languages, I think, has had quite a big influence on my ergonomic work. And then I got interested in psychology and trained informally to some extent in what was called Reichian therapy, which I like to call organ therapy. That's what Reich himself called it. And I worked for some years as a therapist and as a counsellor, and I'd always had an interest in the use of this therapy in childbirth, because I liked Reich's idea of prevention, rather than trying to get bent trees to grow straight, as he put it. You know, it's a much better use of energy and time to get the trees to grow straight from the word go. So In later life I trained as a midwife. And I worked in the NHS as a midwife for 15 years or so, which was a wonderful experience and a proverbial fly-on-the-wall job. You know, it gives you an incredibly wide picture of humanity in all shapes and sizes and guises. And I'm now retired and working full-time on my books and writings and keeping a big website going. And once I was established in the NHS, I realised I had some disposable income. And I satisfied a long, long cherished wish to get a microscope and try Reich's Bion experiments. I'd read about them 20, 30 years earlier, but I hadn't had any money to put into the project. And I bought a microscope, a very good microscope, and, you know, I've never looked back, really. And the book, Artifices of Fraud, is a result of that work with the microscope. I repeated Reich's basic bion experiments, quite literally with the book in one hand, you know, and referring, twiddling with the microscope in the other, like a nervous cook cooking a new dish.
Yes.
I was very nervous, very much a beginner. Somebody active in orgonomy, the late Dr. Courtney Baker, had taken me through the experiments in Germany very quickly and very briefly. But I seemed to have a knack of making a lot of a little bit of tuition, you know, and that set me off and I got going on my own. And when you read Reich's writings about the bion experiments, you come up against Brownian motions, so I thought I'd better read Brown's paper and see what he really said. And I got a copy of it from the library service, and his description of what he saw sounded very familiar, not at all what you'd expect from reading about Brownian motion in the science textbooks. It sounded much more like Reich's descriptions. And I repeated some of Brown's experiments with pollen, and indeed, you know, he had been describing the bions, and he didn't know what they were, of course. Nobody would have known what they were in 1827 when he did the experiments, and he published his big paper about it in 1828. And then in 1829 he published another paper called Additional Remarks, which is very little mentioned very rarely, in which he seemed to withdraw his interpretation of his original findings. His original findings were very like Reich. He associated these moving little dots that agglomerated into what you might call proto-organisms. He thought he'd hit on the building blocks of life, and he connected his work with other workers in the field. And then a year later he wrote this strange article, Additional Remarks, which is a complete retraction of his original claim. And it really sounded to me as if he'd been novelled by somebody, you know, someone with some power or social influence.
You can go online and find a description of Brownian motion just in Wikipedia page, for example.
Oh, hundreds of them, yes.
You know, any popular science textbook. And what it describes there is really, it's interesting, but it seems quite mundane. But of course, this notion that these molecules are somehow connected with the origin of life, that was a controversy. Now, it was one thing for it to be controversial back in Brown's day when it was fairly early days of the microscope and you know, the tools available to scientists were much more primitive. When we come to Reich's time, when we come to his time, certainly science has moved on a great deal. Particularly in terms of the instruments available to scientists. But so for Reich to come and arrive at some of these same conclusions, same ideas, that was particularly controversial because when Brown was working, there weren't, that was kind of the era of the, you know, the amateur scientist almost, you know, the gentleman scientist.
Yeah.
And although Reich might have been sort of steeped in that tradition, there were professional scientists and scientific institutions that you could come up against. Certainly, he did in a major way.
Yes, absolutely.
His background was in psychotherapy, and he did a lot of good work, as measured by others, in his early career. But it seems that once again, when he arrived in this area of suggesting that these, in his term, was the bions, as you mentioned, was something to do with the origins of life, that they might have been a transitional life form between life and non-life.
Yes.
That, I mean, basically all hell broke loose then.
Yes. I mean, he didn't concoct that out of the blue. Yet, if you study Reich's body of work, you know, from A to Z, It's a major step, admittedly, a great big step, but it is a logical step from where he'd been just before. He focused carefully on his psychotherapy patient's description of something moving in their organism when he broke down their muscular armoring. And he wondered what this something moving was. And he connected it with expansion and contraction, both emotionally and physiologically. In terms of mainstream physiology, the parasympathetic nervous system and the sympathetic nervous system. And he wondered whether those processes of expansion and contraction were basic biological functions that you could observe right through nature, you know, down to amoeba. So he took to studying amoeba. And that brought him to the big question, where do amoeba come from? And he was told the usual story, which should be told even today, you know, that they come from spores attached to vegetation or animals and things. And he started to study what happened to grass breaking down in water, because a typical amoeba culture is hay in water. And he found this new process that nobody else had described, which he called bioness disintegration, where the grass starts to move and wobble a bit, and these highly vitalized little dots break away and start spinning round in the surrounding water, and they also get blisters of these dots in an agglomeration on the edge of the grass with a membrane around them. And eventually these bulging contained vesicles, he called them, or vesicles, I think some people call them, broke away as organisms, you know, with an independent existence. So that's how he came to the bions and the process of bioness disintegration.
So now he published some of these results, and as I say, the response was not particularly favourable from the scientific mainstream.
Not at all, no.
And he then basically said, okay, well, why don't you, some of you at least, replicate my experiments? But
and nobody did.
No, and that's interesting to know why. I mean, what was the, I mean, is it the fact that he was suggesting things about the origin of life that made it controversial per se?
I mean, I think that was the core issue.
Well, what I've, as a lay person, as a very much a non-scientist, I've wondered about this, not just his case, but other scientists working in controversial areas that, you know, seem to be outside the mainstream. And no doubt there are people amongst that group who are completely down a blind alley and just going nowhere, and their work can be refuted quite easily. But I'm not so sure about everyone. I've often wondered what is so controversial about some of these subjects. I mean, in the sense that people don't even want to look at it. It was a bit like Galileo and the telescope. You know, people just didn't want to look at the telescope, because I've always thought if something is so easily refuted, the best way to end the issue is to refute the stuff. Is just say,
absolutely,
okay, we'll look at it. There you go. It's rubbish. It's, you know, a dozen of us have done this. Here's our results. You go away. But
yes, of course.
But that didn't happen.
No. As far as I know, nobody has replicated Rice experiments from his own protocols and disproved, in inverted commas, disproved what he claimed. And quite a significant number of people have repeated them and developed them and discovered new things and expanded them. Nothing, as far as I know, nothing massive has been discovered, but they've certainly been taken on a little bit.
What's your take on the, you know, you say replicated some of these experiments. What's your take on the, like, a straightforward explanation for Brownian motion, or a straightforward, you know, as I say, refutation of Reich's work? I mean, some other scientists did come out and say, oh, well, you know, this culture has been contaminated with bacteria from elsewhere, and that's what you're seeing, et cetera, et cetera. So what's your take on those official explanations, so-called?
Well, this is where we loop back to Brown and his original experiments. What is now taken as Brownian motion, the automatic motion of microscopic particles, suspended in a fluid or even in a gas is assumed to be inanimate and purely physical. And the motion is imparted by the moving molecules of the medium that the microscopic particles are suspended in. And obviously that occurs. There is such a thing as what modern physics calls Brownian motion, and I'm not trying to claim that there isn't. But what Brown was describing is Byrnes motion, Byrnes motility, to use Rice's word. Now, the usual take is, oh, that's just either Brownian motion, you know, when Rice showed his cultures to scientists, or it was contamination. Now, the contamination issue is quite easy to disprove. You can do prepare a bion culture which has been sterilized, you know, into the ground. I've done a, for example, one grass culture I did. I simmered the cultures up to boiling point and held them at boiling point, say, for 20 minutes, 10 times, and then autoclaved them. Now, according to the theories of microbiology, such a preparation should be completely devoid of life. And when you these were all in sealed containers, of course, and when you unseal them and quickly put a drop or two on a sterilized slide and look at it under the microscope, you know, say within 2 minutes of opening it, it's full of moving items, and I've got a video of this on YouTube. So that's one refutation of the contamination theory, and the refutation of the Brownian motion explanation is that if you look at bions very carefully, if you've got a good microscope and you're observant, doesn't have to be that good though, you know, a basic decent student's Chinese model will be good enough. You, as well as the darting about independently, you see pairs of bions coming together and dancing around each other, rather like a pair of stars. You know, you get binary stars, don't you, orbiting each other. It's a bit like that. An attraction and repulsion function that Rice describes. And you also, quite quickly, get groups of them forming with five or six or seven bions, and you can see these pulsating together. If you imagine, say, a roughly a crescent shape, rather like the moon, the end will bend towards each other and then open out rhythmically. And they'll also rotate and make other movements, none of which comes under the category of Brownian motion.
That does sound rather orchestrated sort of movement, doesn't it, really, for something that's supposed to be purely random?
That's a good word to use. I've not thought of that word, yes.
So what did Reich suggest was going on here, and what's your personal kind of thoughts and feelings about it, having read his material and also done some of these experiments?
Well, he had this idea, before he got to this point, he had this idea in his head of the energy behind emotions and instincts and sensation in the human organism. And he sensed he was on the track of it when he saw these proto-organisms orchestrating, to use your word, themselves into existence. And he, very much initially relying on his own organ sensations, to use his word, he found that a bion culture in a test tube produced prickling sensations in the skin for certain people whose energy was lively enough to respond, that it produced, if he worked with it for long enough, it inflamed his eyes, and if you examined them in a completely dark room, where you had to wait for about half an hour for your all optical nerve activity to die out, you could actually see an energy field around the culture. And he found that other people, plenty of other people, could see the same thing. And he conducted further investigations and experiments. I mean, I'm cutting a long story very short here. And he realized he was on the track of some quite powerful energy. And he tried to isolate it so that he could study it in more detail. A fairly old-fashioned mechanistic approach, you know, any physicist would have probably recognized that if you discover a new thing, you try and get a bit of space where the thing is present and a bit of space where the thing is absent and start comparing effects. And he found that he couldn't do that, that the effects seemed to spread everywhere. And he put the cultures in a Faraday cage, and that had no effect. And then he tried insulating the Faraday cage with layers of an electrical insulating material. And he found that that actually increased the effects. And that was the accidental invention of the organ accumulator.
Yes, because what we're talking about here, you mentioned orgonomy at the top of the hour. Orgon is this energy force that we're talking about.
And
this,
yes, he gave it the name orgon, orgon energy, yes. And initially bioenergy, and then as his studies became more specific, he decided it needed its own name, and he called it orgon.
And this, I believe this somewhat derived from some of his earlier work on sort of on sexuality, and which was part of his early psychotherapy work. And actually, it's worth mentioning at this point that we talked earlier about him being unconventional and ruffling feathers. Well, he'd already done this in a big way with his work, particularly when it went from psychotherapy, like crossed over into issues of human sexuality and the orgasm and what have you. And of course, he wasn't a trained biologist. That would certainly ruffle even more feathers. We mentioned, you know, Brown in the era of the gentleman scientist, but by Reich's time, it was becoming more tightly controlled in the sense of like, oh, so you're not trained, you know, which...
Yes, of course, yes.
And he was I believe he was homeschooled for much of his early life, and that in itself is, you know, another thing that some people regard as questionable somehow.
Yes, but he did have a medical training, and so he'd done basic microscopy and microbiology as a medical student. And he'd actually studied nature, you know, butterflies and insects and things. So if you read his biography, you know, with a private tutor, he'd probably got a lot more contact with real living life than kids in the classroom, I would guess. I mean, not that that's a big point to me. But using that as a criticism to dismiss him, I think, is completely phony.
Yes, well, I mean, again, it's kind of like, look at the work, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, that's yeah.
There shouldn't be any other standard. I mean, yes, you wouldn't want to go into hospital for a brain operation with someone who's, well, who said, well, I'm not a trained brain surgeon, but trust me, I can do this. I mean, that's probably a bridge too far. But with something like experiments and experimental results, I mean, look how many of the great discoveries in science were made by essentially amateurs.
Absolutely, yes, indeed.
And of course, it was the orgon accumulator, this device, which is initially built on a small scale to test on animals, and then eventually built one about the size of a telephone booth.
Yeah.
He had identified positive benefits of this energy and set about trying to prove some of the benefits with various treatments. And it was this path that he went out on over quite a number of years. It eventually cost him at least one job and eventually his reputation and a lot more, actually, which we'll come on to.
Well, you could say it cost him his life.
Well, again, for me, looking at it from a layperson's perspective, it was like, okay, I've read the accounts where they've said, oh, well, Reich was claiming to be able to cure cancer and he was making money off these machines and he's a fraud. And I can see why somebody, that information be put in front of someone. They might want to say, if they're an official, say, okay, well, we'll check this guy out. But just the vehement reaction, the visceral reaction against what he was doing seemed to be just out of all proportion. Certainly initially when he was just conducting some seemingly harmless experiments to try and establish, you know, the principles of what he was working with.
Yes, absolutely, you're right there. And you still come up against this, the vehemence of this response. You know, you just assumed to be raving bonkers if you say anything positive about any of these experiments.
Well, I mean, the thing with that is, not to talk about Reich's work specifically, but how many things over the years have been established scientific facts until actually it's been revealed, oh, no, they're not anymore, actually we've realised they're not, and how many things have been written off as impossible or crazy that later just quietly became accepted.
Because, well, many, exactly, yes.
Yeah.
My position, you asked earlier about my early experience and my take on things, is not to stand on the top of a mountain, you know, waving a flag about these things. It's just to quietly do the experiments, repeat them as best you can from his books, one by one, and confirm or refute his findings. And in almost all cases that I can think of, I mean, I haven't done all of Reich's experiments because I haven't got the facilities or the money for some of them. But the ones I have done, and there are quite a few, you know, like the microscope experiments and building organ accumulators and the experience of organ therapy and so on, they all confirm his findings. I mean, the very simple one, with the going back to the organ accumulator, you know, is to make yourself an organ accumulator. Anyone who can knock up a bookcase, you know, for their student books or something like that, can make an accumulator. It doesn't demand cabinet-making skills or anything to work. And I built my first one a long time ago and sat inside it to test his assertion that if you sit in an accumulator, your temperature goes up slightly. And sure enough, it did. Now, of course, getting that to happen once doesn't mean a thing. But I've had dozens and dozens, probably, you know, even hundreds by now, people sit in my accumulators and their temperature goes up slightly every time. I don't think I remember a single occasion when it didn't go up. And Reich explains that as a mild parasympathetic influence on the general physiology.
Now, he had some contact with Albert Einstein.
Yes.
And initially Einstein had him over and spoke with him for a few hours. And Reich was keen for Einstein to look at this particular part of the work with the accumulators. Now, Einstein apparently did something on this. He did try it out, and he wasn't convinced that what Reich thought was happening was actually happening, and this refers to the rise in temperature. And Einstein put this down purely to variations in temperature throughout a given space anyway.
Yes, that's right.
So, but what you're describing seems like something quite different.
Yes, that's a further experiment which I have done on a rather primitive level, and it's quite difficult to do it in what you might call a watertight way. To do that, you need your accumulator and a control container, which has the same thermal properties as the accumulator, but no organ accumulating capacity. And I've rigged up a fairly simple setup following an article, instructions on how to do it, in an American journal called the Annals of the Institute for Organomic Science. And that seemed to confirm Reich's findings, but my setup was fairly primitive and I wouldn't tub-thump about it because it's probably not accurate enough. But Dr. James DeMayo, who you may have heard of, the American organomist, he has put a huge amount of time and energy into repeating this experiment and overcoming the various objections about thermal influences, you know, because it is difficult to get an environment where the temperature is even throughout the space that you're measuring the temperature in, if you follow me.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I thought I'd got some lovely readings, and it turned out that the temperature differences were caused by a nearby cold wall on the outside of the building. So you do have to work really hard to produce an environment where the temperature is even everywhere. It is really quite difficult to do. You need a completely insulated space with still air and no temperature variations. And then you put your accumulator in and your control container. And DeMayo has, I think you can find this on his website, you know, he's measured the temperature difference over long periods.
Well, we'll come back to ergonomy again, towards the end. But can't talk about Reich without mentioning the Cloudbuster. Now, this may ring a bell with some people because it's cropped up in popular culture. And, of course, these days, cloud seeding and what have you is nothing out of the ordinary. But this was a device that Reich constructed. Again, it was used with channeling orgone. It rather resembles a mobile rocket launcher.
Yes.
Or it did. I'm not sure if any of them still exist. But
there are a few about. Yes, I've seen a few.
And a very impressive-looking piece of kit. As the name suggests, the idea was that you could induce rainfall, you could, precipitation, by channeling this energy. And that's something that, again, he claimed positive results for. And in fact, on at least one occasion, he got paid for doing it.
Yes,
so
he did.
Either it was a fluke coincidence or so there was something to the technology. But that was another thing that he got rubbished about. It was almost like no matter what he would do next, no matter, what area it was in or what the nature of it was, that he was, a marked man, as it were. He was damaged goods. He was tarnished, and he was never going to be able to do anything to redeem himself once he got past a certain point in his career.
Yes, I'm afraid that's the case. And that's the case now, in that anything you do that you connect with his name is just, ridiculed, laughed off the stage without anyone giving it any serious attention at all. And that's a huge barrier to overcome. I haven't overcome that in my own work, and I just don't know how to overcome it. If anyone listening has got any bright ideas, I'd be very pleased to hear them.
Now, obviously, the work with orgone has continued. Yes. Are you aware of anyone else who's constructed anything like one of these cloud busters and attempted to do anything with it?
Well, again, James DeMeo is the world authority in that field. He has constructed cloud busters and conducted cloud busting operations in various places, mainly in Africa and Southern Europe, from Eritrea, Morocco, as far as I remember, Israel, Greece, and written reports on them, which have been published. And you can find those on his website, which I'll give at the end of our talk. And there's a journal, Pulse of the Planet, is an occasional journal. The last issue was a long time ago, but I think it's still available as, he's kept it in print. And that carries reports of some of his cloud-busting work. And I have actually seen one of his cloud-busters in action. I attended he used to run summer seminars, and in 2005 I think I was there in the middle of a massive drought. There hadn't been any rain for many weeks, and it was oppressive. It was so hot, it was becoming oppressive, and he tried to generate a breeze. There was no moisture in the atmosphere for miles and miles. It was that arid blue colour, as far as you could see, right to the horizon in all directions. So he said, there's no hope of bringing any moisture in, but we might get a breeze going if we're lucky. And sure enough, a breeze did spring up after about half an hour. Now, of course, again, one occasion doesn't prove a point, but it did do what he thought it might do. And that's my sole experience of cloud busting. I've not built a cloud buster. I've not used one. And all I can say is I know the theory.
Well, we mentioned earlier that the authorities in the US, because by this stage Reich had moved to America,
yes,
they were taking an interest in what he was doing with these orgone accumulators, the claims that he was making,
yes,
or claims that other people claimed he was making, which weren't always the same thing. And eventually it was the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration,
yes,
this was their area, as it were. And they decided that, he shouldn't be able to sell or hire any more of these things. So therefore, an injunction was brought out to stop him shipping them around the country. Basically, he couldn't ship them from the state where he was based. But one of his colleagues, while he was out of town, did send one.
That's right,
it actually looked like entrapment to me, because the person who requested the accumulator was actually working for the feds. He was then basically summoned to court to answer for the breach of this injunction, Reich was, and he didn't go. He didn't see that it was an appropriate arena, really, to be discussing these things. The upshot of all this was that he actually ended up being put in prison.
Yes. For breach of the injunction.
Yeah, exactly. And the most outrageous part of this for me is that his staff and colleagues were ordered by the feds to destroy the remaining accumulators. And also, and this is the amazing bit, I still can't get my head around in this day and age, or I would say only, you know, mid-20th century, burned 6 tons of his books.
Yes.
Any reference whatsoever to Orgone, they were all had to be destroyed. And to me, that's just like, you know, in the news this week in the UK, or last week rather, I've heard some politician or other, some Scottish politician, said, should we allow Mein Kampf to be on sale in the UK? Should we ban it? And it just feels like such old news. And it's that mentality. What could there possibly be in a book? You know, if the guy's a crackpot, then he'll be proved to be so, you know, by his own work. So I just thought that was outrageous.
Well, it is, isn't it? And as somebody said recently to me, a new contact, who's got in touch with me through my website, you know, the proof of the pudding, in a way, is the vehemence, the strength, the energy with which Reich is endlessly attacked. Now, people don't put that sort of energy into criticising flat earthers, for example.
No, exactly, because it's kind of like they just ignore them because it's...
Exactly, yeah. I mean, there's all sorts of nutty points of view and claims being made all the time by thousands of people, as you said earlier. And nobody takes any notice of most of them. But somehow, Reich, they just cannot leave him alone. And I think the obvious explanation is that on a gut level, these people attacking him know he's right, and they're frightened of it.
Well, I suppose, I mean, the treatment meted out to him in retrospect is a little bit like, you know, Tesla is another well-known character who suffered a great deal with his work when he was around, but has, or it's still people who dismiss his work, but it's strange how some of his ideas are becoming vindicated as time goes on, and who knows what might happen with Reich's ideas in the future.
Well, they are nibbling their way into not quite the mainstream, but, you know, the edges. They're nibbling in from the edges one way and another, very slowly. I think Tesla is more acceptable because, as I don't know a great deal about him, but as far as I can see, he was just a technologist, a very clever technologist. Mm-hmm. Whereas someone dealing with the human core, our very sense of what we're about and how we ought to live is much nearer the knuckle.
Yeah, definitely.
Much more threatening.
But ultimately, Reich never saw the outside of prison again. He died in there.
Yes.
And it just seemed like a particularly ignominious end under the circumstances.
Terrible, yes.
One interesting tidbit of information I picked up when reading about him was that there were actually a number of well-known people who used Orgone accumulators back in the day. Sean Connery, of all people.
Yeah.
Allen Ginsberg, the beat poet, Jack Kerouac. And yes. Robert Anton Wilson, who's was a well-known alternative writer.
Yes.
And people might be, if they're familiar at all with the Cloudbuster, as it makes an appearance in Kate Bush's song Cloudbusting, also the accumulator itself turns up as the orgasmatron in Woody Allen's 1973 film Sleeper. So I think it was around that time in the 70s that I think his book started to appear in English, and there was definitely a lot of interest, again, not from mainstream scientists, but there was quite a lot of interest in what he was saying.
He was a public figure then in those days. He was in the news and his books were talked about and published, and Reichian therapy, as people used to call it, was not fashionable, but it had some sort of purchase in London. You know, there were a few centres opened up and it became known and more popular. There was definitely a bit of a fashion for Reich in the 70s.
What resonates with me thinking about some of his basic ideas is how much talk there is today in mostly in alternative scientific circles, but not exclusively by any means,
mm-hmm.
of a form of life energy kind of permeating everything.
Yes.
And with respect to the implications this might have for the origins of life. So that's not an uncommon topic or line of investigation today by any means.
it's a strand that's been present in biology, you know, ever since biology appeared as a science.
Mm.
And going right back to the Greeks, the ancient Greeks.
Is this, is vitalism, for example, is that,
yes,
that sort of idea?
Yes.
Well, it kind of resonates with me, I must admit, you know, on a personal level, just because of the idea of, you look around at, you know, the reductionist mechanistic model of science is kind of increasingly being revealed to be inadequate or in some cases completely inaccurate.
Yeah.
And as well as this life force, there's a lot of research now dealing with the intelligence of nature. For example, the idea that the universe itself is alive in some way.
Yeah.
So that for me, that's the direction of travel that a lot of research is going. And I think that the mainstream science, it tends to, you know, literally divide things up into little pockets and work in isolation. That is not necessarily refuting any of these bigger ideas about holistic systems. It's just that people aren't putting the pieces together. Not in, for the most part, in mainstream science or not. They're off working on their own little discrete pockets. And it's not often that people stand back and say, what's this pointing to? What could this, you know, how do these things interrelate? And that's partly, again, because of the scientific disciplines thing. You know, if you're a chemist, then you shouldn't be allowed to do physics or whatever.
Well, that's a great thing, isn't it? Mainstream science doesn't make connections. People are working in their own little bubbles, separated from each other. I mean, Bernd Senff, who's a German organomist and student of Reich, he reckons as a scientific commandment, thou shalt not make connections.
Mm.
Which I think is a very good point. You know, in a nutshell, that you mustn't connect things. And when you work in organomy, you do get used to making big connections. And it's just staggering how mainstream science refuses to make them.
Look, for example, in the 20th century and continuing a really increasing pace now in the 21st, what quantum mechanics has been telling us about, seemingly about the nature of reality and how everything appears to be intimately interconnected. Well, and I think that's really important kind of realization. It's still, and it's amazing to me that even after getting on for 100 years of this stuff now, that information is still not being integrated into broader scientific thinking.
It's a absolutely mammoth labor to organize all that. It really will be such a huge labor if somebody decides to get round to it to do it. You know, I think you'd have to start researching it and collecting your evidence by when you were 15 and maybe write your book when you were 60 or 70.
Yeah, but it amazes me that, you know, even when I was at school in the 1980s, in physics, there wasn't a word about quantum mechanics. Nothing at all.
No.
And it wasn't exactly news then.
I mean, is there even now, you know, if you do A-level physics at school, do you learn anything to do with quantum mechanics? Or do you still learn the classical Newtonian stuff?
That would be interesting to look into that, actually. They might touch upon it, I suppose, but I suspect that if you wanted to really get into it, you'd have to then take a degree and specialise in all the rest of it.
Yes.
Well, I've discussed many times on here this phenomenon called scientism. Well, other people have used that term as well, which is a clinging to scientific beliefs, because in some cases that's what they are. I know why people resist sometimes alternative ideas coming in, new paradigms, especially in areas of not just quantum mechanics, but maybe some of the implications of some of those ideas, because it seems very far out. It attracts people who are not just interested in hard science and how things actually are and the latest, you know, the cutting edge developments, but people who are perhaps a bit more flaky. So therefore you get scientific community really, really want to keep those people out. Anybody with any what gets called woo-woo ideas.
Yes.
So therefore, I think that's one of the reasons why contemporary science is hardened quite a lot to ideas. And I think it resists some of them at its own cost, ultimately.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right there. But I think another good reason from scientism's point of view is that if this, to use a loose word for it all, this vitalistic model is correct, you know, if life is organizing itself into existence all around us at a very primitive level, it completely undermines the neo-Darwinian model.
Yes.
It is completely revolutionary knowledge. And it suggests, to my way of thinking, if that force, whatever you want to call it, I mean, I would say, you know, that all their energy is doing that at this microscopic level, it's presumably logical to assume that it's at work in evolution at all levels. And that is absolute anathema to the neo-Darwinian model, that there's some driving force in evolution. You know, their conviction is, they're adamant that evolution is a completely accidental process.
Well, yeah, because then you cross over into the area of teleology then, and there might be some sort of purpose in evolution, or, you know, in the wider universe. And that, again, that's a, as you say, is absolute anathema to the Darwinian model.
Yes.
Well, I refer back to what I said earlier about this work on the intelligence of nature. I mean, that's some of the most interesting science I see being done. And again, from a layman's perspective, when I look at life on Earth and I look at, you know, what I'm talking about, even inanimate, you know, rocks, trees, birds, insects, the whole gamut of life and other forms, shall we say, on the Earth, if not life.
Yes.
I see intelligence and design everywhere, and I'm not talking about intelligent design. We always have to make that clear. But, you know, I see patterns and organization and a tendency towards order. If that's all complete random accident, okay, but I wouldn't, you know, that's not the direction I'm leaning in as things currently stand. I mean, you only have to look up into the heavens as well. Everywhere you look, from down a microscope up through a telescope and every level in between.
Yes, well, I agree with that, of course, and I think many people do. I think it's only the extreme scientists, what's a follower of scientism called? you know what I mean, who I mean. It's only totally unacceptable to people who follow that gospel. What you've just described, that lovely feeling you get when you look out on the cosmos at any level. The macro, all the micro, and anywhere in between. I think most people sense that patterning, that organizing force. I don't think many people would argue with you about that.
Well, I think it's a lot of people's lived experience. It's what they sense.
Yes.
If they ever allow themselves space and time to sense anything like that, that's what they pick up. But of course, we're told from year dot by mainline science that, you know, there's these more, these sort of non-material forces, the things that we might sense, everything that's in our subjective experience is kind of just to be dismissed.
Well, they rubber stamp it as mystical. I mean, that was, to me, what's lovely about Reich's work and orgonomy is that those sensations, those feelings about the cosmos that you've just been talking about so eloquently, that he takes them seriously and finds explanations for them without explaining them away, without poo-pooing them. And it's something that comes up on a therapeutic level, you know, the capacity to feel that oneness with the cosmos, which in our culture, of course, is deeply crippled in most people. And I think that's why we're making such a mess of the cosmos and the world.
Yes.
Because most people don't feel that as an active influence in their own being, in their own lives, and in their relationships with other people.
Yes, in denying, you know, the connection with everything else that is, then we've sort of commodified nature and it's there to be exploited. And even though the negative consequences are coming back to bite us big time, it's still the psychological block we have, I think, about it. That you know, nature is simultaneously our enemy and our dustbin and our resource.
And I think what's so rich about Reich's work is he discovered how this happens. You know, it's the process of armoring, muscular armoring, as he calls it, which all of us, alas, start to build up from birth onwards, and which cuts us off from this lovely feeling of contact with the world around us and with other people. And you see it at present, you know, in little babies and small children who've been mothered well and who aren't too armored in their first few years. You know, they say things and do things which express this sense of contact with the world around them.
Yeah, I mean, this is very important overall. I think, I don't know if you've read any of the work of Joseph Chilton Pearce.
Yes.
But, yes, well, I have. Yeah, well, you'll know then that he talks about this, how we have this fundamental connection with the world around us, unquestioned, you know, when we're children. And then as we get older, that begins to change. But one of the main reasons it changes is because of the culture that surrounds us, kind of basically stamps that out and tells us you know, that, you know, daydreaming and don't be childish and all the rest of it. And I think the basic reason for that is because, generalizing now, but we have a culture that is insane, and that the only way that, you know, children and young people growing up can be made to, they have to be compressed into that in order that the culture as a whole doesn't see itself for what it is. So instead of you know, this is Reich's idea, instead of trying to cure someone of this, the modern approach, psychotherapy, for example, whether it be actual individual psychotherapy or some sort of collective thing that we do as a society, is to make people fit into this insane culture.
Indeed, yes. Yeah. I couldn't agree more. And you can feel this in if you get a little baby, say 6 months old or a year old, you can feel this process occurring in the rigidity of some of their body parts. I do a lot of, or have done in the past, a lot of therapy with babies, organ therapy with babies. And even the baby of one, you know, can be quite stiff and dead in parts, because that process that you're talking about, the stamping out of the life, is already beginning. It's mm-hmm. tragic.
Well, Peter, as we begin to bring things to a close for today, yes. perhaps we should say something about the state of ergonomy worldwide, how you feel about it, what you see going on, because the therapy, some of the therapy that Reich established is ongoing. There are practitioners various places around the world, and these are qualified medical people, and they've moved on to take up ergonomy. I watched an interesting documentary about therapy recently. And so what's your feeling for the kind of, there is clearly interest in it and that work goes on, but I think it's very much like what you referred to earlier. It's sort of quite under the radar and you sort of need to go looking for it.
It's very precarious. It's not pulling in large numbers of young people. So I think its future is pretty wobbly. But there's definite work being done. There's various organizations and teaching programs, mainly in the States and Germany, I would say, are the two strongest countries. It's hardly got any roots at all in the UK. Fairly strong in Greece and Italy, as far as I know, and there are organizations in those countries and in Spain. And there's isolated individuals dotted about all over the place, you know, in Australia, South Africa, Brazil, that I know of. So it's not dead by any means, but its existence is a bit precarious, and whether it'll survive, you know, I don't know. I dearly, dearly hope it will, you know, and I've been devoting my life to its survival. Apart from that, it is filtering into other things, mainstream things, and I'm doing my best to get it to filter into the world of midwifery, for example. I've got a teaching week coming up soon, which has actually attracted a few students to teach the basics of organ therapy and its use in midwifery. So it's not dead by a long chalk, but it's having a difficult time.
Okay, well, Peter, as I say, today we've been talking a little bit about some of the ideas in your book. Once again, just to remind folks, that's called Artificers of Fraud, The Origin of Life and Scientific Deception. Tell folks where they can get that and tell them about your website and any other resources that you think might be useful for people interested in these topics.
Well, my website is ergonomyuk.org.uk. And the organization protecting Reich's heritage in the US is the Wilhelm Reich Infant Trust, and their website is wilhelmreichtrust.org. And James DeMayo, who I've mentioned a few times, his website, very informative indeed, with lots of articles posted, is naturalenergyworks.net. And the Institute of Organomic Science, which I think I also mentioned in passing, that's organomicscience.org. And if you have a look at those three or four, doubtless that will connect you with many other websites and organizations.
Excellent. Well, Peter, thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
And thank you for having me.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening.
If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is legalizefreedom.com. That's legalize-freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Based on current audience numbers, if everyone who tuned in donated just 5 pence per show, that's about 8 cents US, this could become a full-time, fully funded operation, offering more and more often. During October 2014, over 50,000 of you streamed or downloaded at least one show. Total donations were £7, which currently converts to about $11 US. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.